A big thank you to our sponsors because they make this show possible, and I hope that you support them the way they support us. Progress Software is the creator of the most comprehensive developer toolkit for building modern apps on the market today, Telerik DevCraft. With more than 1,100 Telerik.NET and Kendo UI JavaScript components and controls, you can easily build modern, high-performance web, mobile, and desktop apps, as well as chatbots. The toolset also includes reporting solutions, automated testing, and productivity tools, and comes with a range of support options. New this year is a free online training program for all license holders. With this, alongside thousands of demos and source code available, comprehensive documentation, and a full assortment of Visual Studio templates, you'll be up and running with the Progress Telerik and Kendo UI controls in no time. Download a free 30-day trial today at Telerik.com/Hanselman. That's Telerik.com/Hanselman. Hi, this is Scott Hanselman. This is another episode of Hansel Minutes, and today I'm talking with Andrew Locke. He's just published ASP.NET Core in Action with Manning, fantastic three-part book that I've got access to online and that you can purchase as well. We've even put together a 40% off coupon with the code PodHanselman18. I'll tell you that code at the end of the show, and we'll put it in a link in the show notes so you can get the same book, ebook, or physical book for 40% off. How's it going, sir?
I'm good, thank you. How are you doing?
I'm okay. So you survived writing a book. It's like a 700-page book. I mean, you really did it.
It's got some heft to it, yeah. It was hard work. It got there in the end.
I've written a few books as well, and they are something where you like, I'm so excited, I'm writing a book. And then you're like, oh my God, I'm writing a book. And like, oh, what have I done? Why have I done this to myself and my family?
Exactly. Then you realize you got to edit the book, and that's the way it really kicks in.
The editing part really is no fun because you're like, no, every word I wrote is exactly as I wanted it. Like, we don't want to renumber these chapters. It's perfect, but you have to do the work.
You've already reread it by that point, by about 15 times, and now you have to go through again.
It's worth it. So you wrote this on ASP.NET Core 2. Have you been following ASP.NET Core since the beginning, or where do you, you know, kind of what are your qualifications?
Pretty close to the beginning. I was aware of the whole Project K thing vaguely, but I didn't really pay much attention. And it was around about the RC1 time that I actually, there were bits I could, you know, play with. And I wasn't going to break my machine trying to do so, that I really started paying attention. And then I guess it was just before, so I paid attention and played with the bits RC1, RC2, and then I started the book just before the 1.0 release.
Oh, wow. This has been a long time coming.
It has been a long time coming, yeah. And it's been basically had to be rewritten from 1.0 to 2.0 because of that, but it's worth it.
Do you feel like, I mean, we all joke about Microsoft and version numbers and stuff, but, you know, they say wait till version 3. Doesn't it feel like, you know, ASP.NET Core 2.0, 2.1 kind of is version 3? Like, is that the one people should pay attention to?
I feel like, especially with 2.1 being an LTS release, if you're going to just coming in, that seems like a great place to start. Even if you intend to keep up with the current releases, it seems like 2.1 is the place to come in.
Mm-hmm. We should make sure that we expand our acronyms for people who might not be familiar. So LTS means long-term support, right?
Correct. And then there's the, so that, I think it's 3 years of support you get with that. And then if you stay on the sort of the latest releases, which is the current branch, then that's supported. I can't remember the exact dates. You probably know this better than I do, but it's basically supported until the next current release. So you have to make sure you stay up to date if you stay on the current release.
Right. And they announced recently that if you're running ASP.NET Core 2.1 on the full framework, on the one that runs on Windows, that it'll be supported effectively indefinitely.
Yeah, which is great for people who are migrating from .NET framework across.
Which brings up a really good point, because you started in the .NET full framework kind of world, and then Core happened. And I think people might say that Core has a reputation of being, you know, kind of moving fast and breaking things. Or, you know, people may be afraid to go to ASP.NET because they're concerned that it might not be stable.
I think it's it's fair to say that, you know, .NET Core, they are far happy to move fast and, you know, break some things. That has happened. But it feels like at this point that everything has sort of calmed down a bit. .NET Core just offers quite a lot of advantages over .NET Framework at this point, and especially with Microsoft saying that while .NET Framework is going to be supported, it's not going to be getting any more features. It's just .NET Core is the place to be right now.
Mm-hmm. Was that something that that you took into consideration when you wrote this book, that this is going to be around for a while, so you're going to invest your time?
Exactly, yeah. It was sort of clear from the get-go, in a way, that this was where all of the focus was going to be.
Mm-hmm. So where is this book from a difficulty perspective? I think a lot of people who are listening to the show might have experience with ASP.NET web forms or doing work in MVC, which really wasn't a product when we said ASP.NET MVC. It was more of a pattern, but it became a product that had version numbers and thing. There may be a lot of people out there who have MVC apps and they are kind of stuck and not sure what they should do next.
So the good thing with the whole MVC web API patterns is the fact that they've come through to ASP.NET Core. So if you are familiar with those in ASP.NET land, it's hugely transferable across. So you don't really have to worry. They're not directly compatible, but there's enough there that you can change a few namespaces, add a few attributes, and actually you can convert from ASP.NET apps to ASP.NET Core. Not that you necessarily should, but you can.
Hmm.
If you're coming from web forms, it's a bit more of a struggle in the same way going from web forms to ASP.NET MVC was a big jump.
Yeah, that's actually something that I have a little of experience with because my blog still runs ASP.NET web forms, nearly 15 years old. And people tease me for not upgrading it, but it works fine. So why should I bother? But I did a show recently with my buddy Mark Downey, who has taken this 15-year-old web forms app and converted it to .NET Core. And he did it by, you know, managing separations of concerns. And he made the front end MVC, even though it was originally web forms, but the engine was basically .NET standard and didn't have too much trouble converting it into Core. And suddenly it's cross-platform.
I think that's really the crux of it. It depends how well your app is architected initially. If it's essentially just a UI wrapper around whatever it is, then .NET standard as well means you can plug in a Xamarin front end if you need to.
Exactly, and that's what he ended up doing. And while the front end did require some extra work, the engine, right, you know, the data access layer and all of that stuff really just moved forward quite nicely.
I think that's what I found quite a lot. I've done a bit of conversion of ASP.NET apps to run on ASP.NET Core, primarily because we want to run them in Docker. We want to be able to have better sort of DevOps processes around them, which is just, it's frankly easier in ASP.NET Core than it is running on .NET Framework on Windows.
Mm-hmm. I think it's funny that people, I don't know if you've had this experience, but when I get ASP.NET apps running cross-platform or when I get it running in Docker for the first time, I'm always just a little bit amazed that it still actually works. You know what I mean? Like, I think new people who are listening to this might not understand that, but people who've been working in .NET for many years might go and say, wow, that's really a thing. It runs in Linux.
It's totally. The first time I ran my very first ASP.NET Core app on a Mac, just natively on a Mac, not having to try and work mm-hmm. through parallels and use all these weird shortcuts because it didn't work one way or another. The first time it works, it is kind of mind-blowing.
Mm-hmm. So I did work in MVC and I wrote books on MVC, but then I kind of took a break and I'm noticing that the thing that's the most powerful thing about ASP.NET Core, and I wonder if you agree, would be this idea of the middleware pipeline. And you spend a lot of time talking about that.
Yeah, totally. It's a completely different way of thinking about your app compared to certainly the WinForms way. In MVC, in ASP.NET, there was the move towards Owen, Katana, as a web server. And that's really inspired ASP.NET Core. So if you have worked with that in ASP.NET, then that will be very familiar.
Mm-hmm. So Owen, it'd be the Open Web Interfaces in .NET. It was a community project to describe, you know, a way to plug middleware together in a non-version specific and a non-vendor specific way, right? It was a way of kind of giving more control to the people, I would say.
Yeah, exactly. It was, and I'm not sure exactly where the inspiration was for Owen, or if it did come from Node was doing a similar thing as, you know, composable bits of middleware to build up your pipeline. But it certainly, if you're from the Node world, it's very similar to the way you build a Node app.
When I was doing ASP.NET, though, I was doing HTTP handlers and HTTP modules and plugging them into IIS. Is that not the same as a middleware pipeline?
It's similar in some ways, but it's also different in others. Fundamentally, the way the handlers and the modules worked was different. For one, you're hosting in IIS, which is different in .NET Core. .NET Core is now you host the web server within a console app. It's just a normal .NET console app, as you would just write to the command line. Modules and handlers, they were frankly a bit complicated. You had to understand the entire pipeline of a request and what was happening where, all the different events that are raised at different points, and IIS would then call into your application at the appropriate points. With .NET Core, you define the entire pipeline, exactly how a request should be handled within your application. So you can have different bits of middleware for different cross-cutting concerns and generate the response based on the incoming request.
Mm. And you get an opportunity to say yay or nay and then move on to the next thing in the pipeline. Like in your chapter 3 on middleware pipelines, you've got some really great diagrams, by the way. And I see the amount of work that you put into drawing these diagrams to really explain visually what's going on. You call out like static file middleware, error handling middleware. Each different piece of middleware as it moves through the pipeline gets an opportunity to say, I care about this, or no, go ahead to the next thing.
Exactly. And so each piece of middleware, just it can inspect the request. If it knows how to handle it, it can just generate a response and that's it done. Alternatively, it could add some headers, it could change the request somehow, or it can completely ignore the request and pass it on to the next piece of middleware.
Mm-hmm.
That next piece of middleware can decide what it wants to do, and it can pass it on to the next one and so on. And then once something generates a response, each piece of middleware that has seen the request then gets to see the response as well. So the response passes back down through this pipeline.
Briefly, a word about NetApp. NetApp is a developer's dream for data management. NetApp can manage, migrate, store, compress, clone, encrypt, secure, and generally make data do things super fast that data doesn't always like to do. NetApp gives developers infrastructure superpowers with Azure NetApp Files, the only Azure service that lets you move enterprise file share workloads to the cloud in minutes. Register today and learn how you can get Azure NetApp Files for yourself at NetApp, that's NetApp.com/Azure Preview. Someone said once that they felt that ASP.NET Core embraced that HTTP existed more than previous versions of ASP.NET that they felt were trying to hide that HTTP existed.
That totally makes sense. I mean, especially from the web forms point of view. Web forms was obviously, I mean, that was trying to sort of gloss over the fact that the web existed. It was trying to make it, you know, nice and quick and easy to create web applications by just ignoring the fact there's an enormous pipeline between, you know, the client and the server. MVC sort of exposed a bit more of that and the web API much more, but this just takes it that even further.
So when you say ignoring the fact, you're like basically saying, pretending that this even exists and telling people, don't even pay attention to that. Don't look behind the curtain there.
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah, I felt like as the web decided with REST and with JavaScript or vanilla JavaScript to really embrace that, okay, let's stop hiding things. Let's stop hiding the browser. Let's stop hiding the DOM. Let's stop hiding HTTP. Things got cleaner and easier in MVC. And your part one, where you basically introduce people to MVC, you talk about model binding, razor views, mapping URLs, and the middleware pipeline. Almost an entire book, but it's condensed. It's simpler. You spend a lot less time getting to the point than I would say I did in my books.
I think part of that is probably just because these concepts have been around for a bit longer now. If you've already experienced ASP.NET, for example, then you're already vaguely familiar with most of these concepts, if not very familiar, depending on exactly which aspects you've been working with. So it's just one of those things where it's just in the general consciousness more, I think, that you have to understand how HTTP works a bit, at least, in order to do web development.
Another new concept that people have to understand that has gone from being something that I think maybe the fringe or the more advanced developers did to now everyone does is this idea of dependency injection, which we used to have to shove into ASP.NET to get it to work.
Yeah, it was always really hard work. I mean, I remember, on the one hand, I remember suddenly discovering dependency injection when I had just sort of started programming, and it made so much sense for simplifying a lot of code. And then trying to put it into ASP.NET was such hard work that you'd often question whether it was worth the hassle or not. It was possible. It was totally possible, and we did it. But it's because it was clearly an afterthought tacked on, mm-hmm. whereas it's baked into ASP.NET Core. They use it throughout, whether you want to or not. I know some people are against DI generally, but the framework itself is built very much depending on dependency injection. So you may as well embrace it, frankly.
Well, I wonder how anyone could be against it. I was trying to figure out the best way to teach it or to explain it to someone, because as with all kind of like mind-bending concepts, it's one of those things where you have to look at it multiple ways, and then eventually it'll pop, it'll click, and you'll go, oh, and then it all makes sense, right? So how do you express that? How do you teach someone what that means? Like when you say inversion of control, that makes it sound like you need a PhD to understand what's going on.
It does. And there's always the arguments as well, the fact that, you know, dependency injection isn't the same as inversion of control.
And yeah, see, but you know.
I can never remember quite exactly which the arguments are, which way, to be honest. The main thing that I find is it just makes unit testing things easier a lot of the time. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. If you can inject, you know, an interface instead of a concrete version of a class, then you can test that class in isolation. You can test without having to, if you've got an email sending application, for example, you can inject this, an interface which does the actual email sending itself. And then you can test, you know, how the email is generated and error handling, that if the email sender throws an exception, that you can handle that without actually having to send emails. It's just that simple thing there. Just making testing so much easier makes it worthwhile in my book.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. The website, in fact, that runs this this podcast is written in ASP.NET Core, and I would have to admit that in writing little apps myself, little personal apps, I'm not one to do a lot of testing. But the testing is so easy in ASP.NET Core that for the first time, my personal projects have an extensive test suite.
Yeah, I'm very much the same. Very much the same. Well, the one thing I particularly like with the testing of ASP.NET Core is the fact that you can do integration testing of your HTTP requests without having to spin up servers. That's been really quite useful for just testing end-to-end. It's people have different feelings about, you know, the various balance of whether you should have unit tests out versus integration tests or end-to-end tests, you know, whatever you want to call them. But just the ability to be able to quite easily spin up integration tests is really valuable.
That's a great point. There's so many layers. I mean, you can spin up and test ASP.NET Core without spinning it up. Like you can just make in-process calls without any web server, or you can put a web server on it, or you could even do HTTP in-memory testing without an actual web server. Or if you feel like it, you can automate the browser and do full-on end-to-end Selenium testing and put the browser on the puppet strings.
Exactly. It's there's a lot of options. I think that's the difference, is that you really do have a lot of options. With web forms, yeah. you just didn't have those options available. You know, you could do Selenium and you can do very low level tests, but you couldn't do that very easily. You couldn't do that sort of in between level tests that you have now.
Before I forget, one of the things about dependency injection that I have been using to explain to people is to say, it's not your application's job to new things up, to go and make new objects. Your application should be asking for objects, because your app doesn't want to think about object lifetime and how long scope should be of something. It just wants something. It just wants to send an email. So why does it need to suddenly, as a business application, be responsible for making an object and throwing it away at the right time and letting it live for the certain amount of time? Those things are concerns that it shouldn't have.
Exactly. It does simplify your like you say, your application logic a lot. One thing I would say is that just because your application logic doesn't have to think about those things doesn't mean that you can just not think about them. You're basically delegating that decision down to this dependency injection container, and you do have to bear that in mind. I've seen a few issues where basically I've been using the wrong lifetime without really thinking about it. I just, you know, you just register something with a DI container and, you know, don't really think anything more of it. And then down the line, you start getting strange issues because you've registered it as a singleton instead of a scoped service or something like that.
Well, that's a really great point that you're making, and it's something that people could hurt themselves with if they didn't think about lifetime. They could just start injecting dependencies and forget about lifetimes, and you spend a non-trivial amount of time. You have a whole section on understanding lifetimes to make sure people get that right.
And I think that's the key thing with dependency injection. If you can understand the lifetimes and, you know, why you shouldn't inject scoped services into singletons and things like this, then after that, it's all quite easy. It's fundamentally just building up a graph of new objects. And so once you can get that concept, then basically all the difficulty is just managing lifetimes.
In part two of the book, once you've moved past the kind of the getting started and the concepts, you start talking about really building complete apps. Like, what does it look like in reality? Let's stop talking about samples and start talking about real stuff like authentication and authorization and actual publishing and stuff like that. But well, I was a little bit surprised you have an entire section, an entire chapter on the filter pipeline, which I thought was an interesting decision.
It's a complex beast, unfortunately, when you get into it.
Mm-hmm.
It's one of those things that it's easy to just pick and choose little bits of the filter pipeline and only use the ones you need. The main thing with the reason for having a whole chapter on it was almost meant to be a reference guide, to be honest. There's lots of bits and pieces around in documentation, and the documentation in general is very good now. But understanding the different filters, when you should use each filter, how they interact when an exception is thrown at some point in the MVC pipeline, whether a result filter is used, whether a response filter is used, it's all quite complicated. Arguably, it didn't need to be an entire chapter, but yeah, getting the information down, that's what it was.
Well, I'm in no way implying it shouldn't be a full chapter. I just thought it was a cool decision because effectively, if I understand from reading the chapter, the filter, MVC filters are almost a pipeline within a pipeline, right? Because MVC itself is a middleware.
Exactly. Yeah. The MVC filters, like you say, they're not a linear pipeline like the middleware. They are slightly sort of convoluted, but they are a pipeline. And in fact, I think it was in 1.1 introduced the middleware as filters feature into ASP.NET Core. So you can actually use middleware components as MVC filters. I think it was that way around. That really just highlights how the fact that they are just another pipeline. Yeah.
Right. And again, I have to give you kudos, so forgive me if I'm gushing a little bit too much, but credit to you for doing not just a lot of prose and code, but also illustrating this stuff with illustrations that explain the pipeline. I don't think that I have understood fully the MVC filter pipeline until I saw the diagrams that you created. Because as you said, it's not just boxes on top of boxes. There is some kind of going off in the corner here to do action invocation and then coming back and some optional things. And when exceptions happen, it's even more different.
Yeah, it's a complicated beast. Like you say, you need to have some pictures in there. So I'm glad they helped.
when you're writing a book and simultaneously the documentation is becoming better because clearly the docs team has really gotten their act together. How do you decide like what goes in a book and what is something that you'd send someone up to the documentation for? And how do you kind of compete when you have a physical book versus ever changing docs?
Yeah, well, I think it depends what people are trying to get out of the book and versus why they were going to the documentation. I think the docs are, like you say, they're so much better now. They're even better than when I started the book, to be honest. When I started, they were a bit all over the place, but now they're very consistent. The difference, I think, is there's different types of tutorial versus reference document that they have in docs, and they try to pull those out as two different bits. If something is essentially a technical reference. You don't want to read that in a book. There's no reason you're going to sit there and, you know, read about the API or every single minutia of something. The book is right. meant to be, it's a story of sorts. It's taking you through, it's through the application, so it's not really a story, but it needs to have some interest, frankly, as opposed to just, I just need to get this one little thing done, which I find right. a lot of time, that's why I'm on docs.
I think that's a good point. The even though a book is a random access thing, the linearity of it to, like, you know, let me tell you a story. Let me walk you through this. Follow me on this vector from chapter one all the way through, you know.
Exactly.
And also the physicality of the book, frankly. I still have a stack of books next to me actually right now that I'm going through. You really can't learn a framework unless you do that linear chapter one through chapter 20, you know, at least once or twice.
Yeah. Yeah, I completely agree. And they have, I don't think they're trying to sort of cover that base in the docs, to be honest. They do have tutorials, but they're generally, they're getting started. They're the on-ramp as opposed to, right, now let's do everything.
You've also put the source code for this on GitHub. So how much of a living book is this?
So the source code is, yeah, it's all on GitHub. There's a combination of some of the samples in there were written in the sort of 1.0, 1.1 timeframe, and they've been updated to be 2.0. This book was finished sort of just before 2.1 came out. So there's various references to 2.1, but the source code currently is covering 2.0 and in some cases the 1.1. I'll make fixes to that as necessary, but I'm trying to leave them as, you know, 2.8 so it matches the book, the physical book, as opposed to necessarily keeping it, you know, up to date with the 2.2, 3.0 releases or anything like that.
Well, I mean, certainly with 2.1 being LTS, the 2.x ASP.NET Core concepts aren't changing and the APIs are changing minimally. So it doesn't seem like people should be focused on daily builds of ASP.NET Core when, in fact, this is one that's going to be around for many, many years to come.
Exactly. And the book itself, I don't cover everything in there. It's just there's too much in the framework and it's changing too fast. So it covers, as you say, like really the core fundamentals and some advanced concepts that you can go a long way with. And those haven't changed at all. So I think that's a good side of it.
Absolutely. It's also worth pointing out for people who are listening that they can go and take a look at manning.com for ASP.NET Core in Action. And you've got free downloads of both Chapter 1, but then as an example, the filter pipeline one that I was gushing about is also a free chapter. You can download Chapter 13 for free. You can look at all the source code all for free before you decide if you want to buy it. And as I pointed out also, because you came on the show, I talked to the folks at Manning, and they put together a coupon code, PodHanselman18, that would get you 40% off of the book, and I believe 40% off anything else on Manning.com, which is pretty cool. And there's a live book combo where you can basically have it on, you know, as an ebook, and then you can read it on the web as well, which is pretty sweet.
Yeah, and I think Dustin Metzger's got another free ebook on manning.com, which includes chapters from this book and from his book and from the EF Core in Action book as well.
Yeah, that's a really great point. So there's ASP.NET Core in Action, and there's .NET Core in Action, which can give you some internals of profiling and performance and multiple runtimes and all the details of .NET Core itself. And just as a point of note, I wrote the foreword for Dustin's book. So I don't have a relationship with Manning, but I do think that those are great books. So that's why I'm having you on the show and why it's worth checking those both out.
Yeah, I appreciate it.
Yeah, absolutely. There's a lot of cool stuff going on right now in .NET Core, and it's so nice to see books and source on GitHub. And I don't know, it's just so different than it was 15 years ago.
Yeah, totally. I mean, having the source code on GitHub was really the thing that got me into .NET Core in the first place. It was being able to just read through and see how things worked and what was happening in there was just such a pleasure.
Well, and I even like the fact that, like, I'm looking right now at your book in chapter one, there's a screenshot of you on Ubuntu, and it has a section here about how to set up. Like, it's a book that doesn't start with, and now download Visual Studio. You literally are like, well, now pick Vim or Emacs or Sublime or Atom or Brackets or whatever, and pick whatever operating system, whatever editor you want, and let's go and do this book. and then you just start going.
Yeah, and that is one of the big selling point with ASP.NET Core, I think, is just the fact that it is, you can build it everywhere, you can run it everywhere. It is such a pleasure to do that. I mean, I'm a Windows guy, and so I build on Windows, but then I generally deploy to Linux, and there's no issues with that.
That's fantastic. Well, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Oh, thanks, Scott. It's been great.
All right. We've been talking about Andrew Locke's book, ASP.NET Core in Action. Be sure to check out the show links down below, as well as the coupon PodHanselman18. This has been another episode of Hansel Minutes, and we'll see you again next week.